IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. It's been a quite fascinating week as far as all things internet are concerned. I would say a fascinating few months, actually. In the last few weeks, there have been two sets of significant developments involving Russia and the internet after several weeks of sustained pressure from the Russian authorities. In mid-September, Google and Apple removed a smart voting app from the Alex Navalny's team. I'm sure I'm murdering his name, but I'm sorry about that. Just before the elections. And as part of its effort to deal with the COVID-19-related misinformation, YouTube took action against two German language channels operated by Russia today. Russia threatened to retaliate by blocking YouTube and German media outlets. All of this is actually quite relevant to the stuff that we do at Takshashila, especially regarding stuff around foreign policy. And as it stands, we currently have India's Global Outlook Survey that's active for the time being. So if you have some time, dear listener, please do look at the link in the show notes and fill out the survey. It only takes 6 minutes and can be vitally important to inform us in our foreign policy research. Right. Having said that, let's begin with Sapni. You are here with us along with Prateek. So please tell us a little bit about what's happening. Let's start with Russia, shall we? What's happening? What's the context in Russia?
So basically, the Russian elections have started happening in September. So for over a year now, the state in Russia has been forcing Apple and Google to sort of toe their line so that the popularity of the government in Russia does not dip and there is no actual challenge against the president, Mr. Putin. So regarding that, on the first day of the Russian parliamentary elections, Apple and Google finally gave in and agreed to the demands from the Russian government that both of them take down an app regarding which was essentially trying to strategize voting from Apple's App Store and Google's Play Store. So both of these corporations essentially now had to bend down to Russian authoritarianism. And in furtherance to that, Apple also for the disabled its private relay feature in Russia, which is basically a privacy-enhancing feature, and YouTube also had to remove certain videos on strategic voting related to Russia. So this is basically what happened in Russia regarding content and foreign policy related. The foreign policy related, of course, it strikes us very clearly that, you know, these are US corporations and these are taking decisions which have certain very alarming consequences in domestic politics of Russia as well as international politics. So this is basically how the things stand right now.
I just want to add a few things, right? You also mentioned the whole YouTube situation, right? Them taking action against channels operated by Russia today. And that's an interesting case. It was really part of a larger operation enforcement action that YouTube was taking against COVID misinformation. And it just so happened that these two channels happened to get swept up in it. And you know, because of that, it's triggered this little bit of a, you know, maybe flashpoint is too strong a word, but there is certainly saber rattling in the sense that, you know, Russia is threatening to throttle or ban YouTube. And it also, you know, there have also been statements from talking about, you know, how they can retaliate against German media outlets by blocking them in the country.
Right. See, the context here is extremely interesting. We'll get into the analysis of it. But it reminds me, this is a bit of a side tangent, but it does remind me of this book I was reading. I'm not sure if I mentioned here before, but I have a reading list that I read 52 books a year. And we'll put the link in the show notes. It's a humble plug. But the book I was reading was called Hatching Twitter. And at some point in time, I don't recall, I think almost a decade ago now, when Twitter is up and coming, it was quite popular in Iran. And it was being used as a tool to express dissent during the Iranian revolution. And so what ends up happening, and I'm fuzzy on the details, so I'm not doing a good job at explaining them. But what basically ends up happening is that the Twitter team has a choice. They know that the revolution at a certain point in time is going to peak. And also, unfortunately, at the same point in time, Twitter is scheduled to undergo maintenance. And so now they have a choice on whether or not they should change their hours of maintenance to make sure that they don't impact Iran's political movement, or they actually do change their hours. So like, it's damned if you do, damned if you don't. And I think a lot of these companies, platforms, I mean, are in sort of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. I don't know if the ethical dilemmas here are clearer in the case of Russia or so. But having said that, that side tangent aside, let's talk about some of the analysis here. Pratik, I want to begin with you. So there's, I think, three broad buckets that you had identified. Do you want to take us through them?
Yeah, before I do that, I just want to add some more Russia-specific context as well, right? Because this is in a way, a long time coming, right? So earlier this year, you know, some of you may recall that Russia attempted to throttle Twitter. And it didn't do a very great job because it was trying to throttle t.co, that domain, right, which has a lot of Twitter images, Twitter attachments, etc. And it ended up affecting even sites like Microsoft and Reddit. And, you know, while the world collectively laughed, I think, you know, Russia came away with sort of newer way of enforcing some sort of censorship regime, right? In terms of, instead of an outright block, you throttle content, which again, you know, depending on the various layers of the technology stack, may or may not be easier to work around, right? As opposed to a blanket ban. There's another thing to keep in mind that Russia does have a law going into effect in January 2022, which requires that foreign companies with large Russian audiences, and then I think that translates to roughly about 500,000 Russian citizens daily, incidentally, that they have to establish an office in Russia, have representatives, add feedback forms to their websites, you know, in case that sounds familiar, right? And which is broadly comply with local requirements, etc. Right. So there's that component as well that they are demanding local representatives, right? From a lot of these foreign companies, right? And again, the pretext is about, you know, servicing Russian audiences, but there is always skepticism around such routes, right? There's another interesting thing is that back in 2019, they had mandated something that was supposed to go into effect in mid-June, which mandated that, you know, all devices in Russia needed to have Russian apps installed. I'm a little unclear on what happened there, because I believe it did get, the enforcement did get delayed. I'm a little unclear, and I wasn't able to really look, you know, I didn't find anything when I looked this up, whether this has gone into effect or not, right? But yeah, the direction is there, right? So which is why when I was actually surprised to see that a lot of people were surprised by Apple and Google taking action against the smart voting app. So now coming back to that little sidebar aside, coming back to, you know, the bucket that you asked me about, right? The first is an interesting one, right? It's about effectively content moderation through the stack, right? And or typically when we think of content moderation, it's, you know, it's what your Facebooks, YouTube, Twitter, etc. are doing with content that users post, right? But when you're talking about content moderation through the stack, it's about, you know, it's about actions from companies up the stream or in lower layers of the technology stack. Like in this case, you had Apple and Google kicking an app off the App Store, right? You can potentially say that that's at a different layer of the stack. But there's another interesting angle here that even Telegram had to take down a few channels that that Navalny's team were using. And as per an interview that the founder gave to, I think it was Radio Free Europe, it seemed like that action was enforced by Apple, and in the sense that they were asked to take down the app or potentially be kicked off the App Store as well, right? And this, again, now content moderation through the stack, it's not new. It's happened multiple times before, all right? When you think back to, you know, when Alex Jones' InfoWars was deplatformed, Parler was deplatformed, right? But to some extent, even if you look at VPN apps being removed from the Apple App Store in China, right? Or I think Apple taking down the HK Map live app during the 2019 Hong Kong protests, right? So there's plenty of precedent here. It's also notable that it's either praised or criticized depending on what the action is, and not specifically, not always going to the broader question of, hey, should companies be doing this? Are they within their right to do this? Again, there are several arguments to be made Interestingly, and I'm again going off a little bit of sidetrack here, but even if you've been following the Facebook files, right, even in that, in the specific article about human trafficking, right, there is an element of content moderation to the stack here, because it seemed like Facebook quickened its action on human trafficking after there were some concerns flagged by Apple, right, and talking about potential repercussions for the app on the App Store. So this whole app, you know, this whole idea of content moderation through the stack is an extremely interesting phenomenon. It's basically companies enforcing their terms of service, right, which has, you know, there are very good reasons for doing so, but it manifests on the internet in various and interesting ways.
That's actually quite concisely put. And before I have a few questions, I do want to elaborate more on this. But before we do that, let's take a quick commercial break. Hi, we're back. And I am joined by Prateek and Sapni. We are keeping up with the Sprinternet, as to say. Thank you, Prateek, for your insights on content moderation to the stack. There's also sort of two other buckets that I was going through your notes and looking at them. So this complying with local regulation and rapid and global scale decision making. So talk to me a little bit about those.
Okay, sure. So with, you know, complying with local regulation, it's a very interesting thing, and I'm drawing on some of my own time working with, you know, working as part of a team that did content delivery networks operations for Russia and China. And this is something that you hear a lot, right? When you take certain action, it's normally justified as, hey, we're just complying with local regulation. And, you know, as a concept, that doesn't seem bad. In fact, a lot of times people ask for it, that, hey, if you're operating in a certain country, if Facebook is operating in XYZ country, it should absolutely comply with local regulation, right? It seems like a fairly unambiguous thing to say. But, you know, again, let's come back to Russia for a second. And again, you know, I referenced the fact that Apple had issued a warning to Telegram. The same interview I referred also spoke about, you know, why that warning went out. And it seemed like there was a contravention of local regulation about election silence, right? Which is, if you think of it, not that remarkable at all, right? A lot of countries have a period before polls where you're not allowed to campaign, right? Now, the Russian authorities were basically able to justify that this amounts to campaigning, and they were, you know, they were able to enforce action that way, right? And again, you know, as Sapni mentioned earlier, they've been ratcheting up the pressures through the year, and part of that is because they classify, you know, Navalny and his supporters as, I think, being engaged in extremist action, and, you know, they were able to justify a lot of their action that way, and it left companies with this dilemma of, hey, do we comply with local regulation or not? And that is really a trend that, you know, and it's not unique to Russia, right? There was this very interesting article in Rest of World back in May, and I think we can include that in the show notes. But it basically talks about how you have similar regulation in a whole bunch of countries, including, I think, Pakistan. And interestingly, I just saw this, I think, minutes before we started recording, is that Nigeria, which had banned Twitter earlier this year, is giving some indications that, you know, it may lift the ban if Twitter were to open up local offices and pay taxes in Nigeria, right? So these kind of laws have been called hostage-taking laws. And yeah, it seems to be a trend that we're seeing.
Thanks for that, Prateek. I do want to ask Sapni about the hostage lawfare situation. So Sapni, do you want to come in and brief us a little on that?
So essentially, these sort of hostage-taking laws, what is called hostage lawfare, using law to get, at the end of the day, to achieve your goal, through whether or not they are positive or negative is obviously up for discussion. But hostage lawfare, as Prateek mentioned, it's been going on in the space of digital regulations, in the space of cyberspace regulations. It's more and more present everywhere. So particularly talking about Russia, there are two important aspects to the regulation. One was that, of course, the prosecution of Russia-based employees of these corporations, that was one major part of the law. And second was how Russia was going to slow down internet traffic to Apple and Google platforms. This is how they have tried to figure out their version of the Great Firewall, something called the RUNET. And further, the use of deep packet inspections for governments to track and filter content. So there is censorship, and there is obviously there is the idea of reiterating national sovereignty over the internet. So that is that really brings us to the point that, you know, censorship is probably taking a high-speed jet and moving towards completely towards the idea of having a clear splinternet instead. And essentially, it changes the fundamental nature of internet as how we see it today. So that, and that obviously has a lot of geopolitical and regulatory aspects to it. So I think this is where possibly this whole incident really fits in. And it is important for us to watch it because of this reason that how each of these incidents further move us as a collective towards the splinternet and how it moves away, yards and yards away from the idea of cyber utopianism.
Right. So I had a really, really cheesy rhyme about that. It used to be something like bit by bit, block by block, towards the splinternet we walk.
I am just going to ignore this and move forward. Thanks for that, Sapni. We really appreciate it. So this sort of brings me to, so the little sort of takeaway that I have here is that I think it's very easy to say that that companies, wherever they are, should comply with local regulation. And I think there is a debate to be had across various disciplines on whether local regulation actually serves. I mean, what is the underlying principle through which the local regulation has been formulated? And this debate rages on if you look at how the right to be forgotten is going to be implemented in India, if the data protection bill ever becomes law, and how it's implemented in Europe, and so on and so forth. So like, it's not as, I think the picture is not as black and white as to say that if you're in a particular country, abide by their local laws. As the Russia incident tells us, that sometimes doing so might come with its own set of problems. And so, and I think that's why the splinternet itself is sort of deeply problematic in my head, because it just, instead of, I know the world doesn't have a common set of values that we all adhere to, but some of the ways in which this stuff is being implemented is just quite disturbing, frankly. So having said that, let's sort of ignore Pratik's rhyme and talk about rapid and global scale decision making. Pratik, do you want to take us through a little bit about that? Why should these people be making choices and the kind of trade-offs that
it's correct. And this is a little bit of a meta point again. But the idea here is, right, you know, for example, YouTube was enforcing this, you know, COVID misinformation policy, right? Now, it just so happened that two channels from Russia Today got swept up in it. And now, you know, we don't know exactly how these internal processes work. You know, were they aware that there were these two channels going in? Did someone flag it? Would they have changed their action otherwise? You know, this is all stuff that we can only speculate on, right? But the general sense is that, you know, there is this expectation that, and I'll take another example, right? If you just go back to mid-August, right, as the Taliban was sort of consolidating in Afghanistan, there was a significant amount of criticism, right, going around that, you know, there is still content that is either sympathetic to Taliban or pro-Taliban that's on these platforms, right? And you're talking about them having policies to enforce it, but obviously people, you know, that sort of content creators are, and I'm using content creators very, very broadly here, you know, are smart enough to get past these rules, right? And what we're essentially expecting these large technology companies, right? And I'm not saying this to say that, you know, it's not from the perspective of, oh, look at these big four technology companies. But this is, you know, it's a genuine question that we're expecting them to make these large scale decisions, right, at significantly low risk, with significantly low response time. And I don't know if they have the capacity to do it, right? And you know, then there's the broader question of, do we want them to do it? Ideally, that should be the first question. But you know, since we're already in the state, they're having to do this time and again, it's something that we probably want to ask in parallel. But you know, it remains to be seen, right? Do they have the capacity to do it? Should they be building up the capacity to do it? Because, you know, I'll just go back to the Taliban aspect. And if you look at, you know, a number of countries haven't yet shown their cards, right? Now, while that is certainly strategic on their part, it's hard for, you know, corporations to take a decision on the or to take a call on that, right? Now, depending on where you stand and which side of the issue you support, it's very easy. You can make that argument, right? But for people working in that company, it's typically an extremely tricky decision to make, especially when, you know, I go back to the point of content creators getting smarter and finding ways around any sort of policies or community standards that you can come up with. And that's not to give them credit, because, you know, there are certain cases where they don't enforce their own community standards, right? And that's certainly an important discussion, but it's a little separate from the point that I'm trying to make, which is, you know, do they have the capacity to make such important decisions of such consequence? And do we want them making it, right? And then the question is, if not, what do we want them to do? And I think that's where we don't really have answers. You know, and a lot of the things that we've discussed is something that I've written about in, I think, the 10th edition of Technopolitics, which would be out by the time this episode gets published. So we'll include the link to that as well.
Excellent. I think that's all we have for today. Thank you so much for joining us, Prateek and Sapni. It was quite wonderful having this discussion with you, especially in the context that we are discussing whether or not Amazon should have a seat in the Security Council. But again, thank you, dear listener, for joining us, and have a wonderful day ahead. Thank you for listening to All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle, @TakshashilaInst, or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.